Good day, nerds, and welcome to episode 162 of the Nerd Cantina Show. And this is a cantina conversation between our book reviewer, Megan McCarthy-Bianc, and Tracy Clark. And Tracy Clark's recent book, Runner, is being featured here in this episode. And as always, Megan has a great conversation with her on her process, where her journey began as a writer. And they even explain why that creepy person on the bus eavesdropping on you might just be an up-and-coming writer. If you're into mystery novels or a fan of Tracy Clark's, I think you'll really enjoy this one. So without further ado, on to the interview.
We are welcoming Tracy Clark here, author of, we're going to talk about Runner today, and but this is the fourth book in the Cass Rains series. I've never read the first three, but now I want to. So, but it was easy to just pick it up at number four. So thank you so much, Tracy Clark. You know, I was kind of telling you before, this book is, it was easy to get hooked. And I really enjoyed it. So thank you for taking the time to talk to us and giving everybody a little something extra.
Fantastic. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. So why don't we get started with like your background and, you know, kind of like what inspired, you know, how you got started into writing, what inspired you for these stories, and maybe talk about why Chicago, you know, and if there's any research involved, stuff like that.
Well, I guess all writers sort of start as readers. So I guess when I sort of started reading for myself, when you sort of got out of the bedtime story phase, I sort of gravitated towards mysteries, Nancy Drew, Hardy Boys, things like that. So that was the stuff that I enjoyed reading. And so when I sort of got the sort of idea that maybe I might want to sort of write a book of my own, mm-hmm. that was a genre that I sort of picked because that's what I enjoyed reading. So that's what I read. Hammett, Chandler, Agatha Christie, all of those great mystery novelists. And it sort of had a sort of projection. I started with those, Nancy Drew, Hardy Boys. And then I sort of got through the Christies and sort of ran through all of those. Then I sort of got to the early 80s when this great wave of female crime writers sort of came out, Sue Grafton, Sarah Paretsky, all the rest of them. So that was sort of in my wheelhouse. I liked mysteries. Now we have this great wave of female crime writers. I wanted to be like that. And so I started sort of teaching myself how to write a story of my own, putting an African-American female, a character like myself, into the story. It took several years, many, many years before I sort of got published and sort of got out there. But, you know, it was all learning, all teaching myself how to sort of tell a complete story, beginning, middle, and end, and then put it in a form that maybe readers might enjoy reading. So a lot of hair pulling, a lot of stress, two steps forward, one back, the whole nine. So typical story for, I think, most writers.
Sure.
It takes sort of a lot of time to sort of prime the pump and to sort of get something on the page that sort of leaps off the page. So, you know, it was a long journey, but well worth it, I think.
Yeah, of course. Well, you won an award for the first one, right? I don't remember if I read anything.
Nominated for the first one, won the Sue Grafton for Borrowed Time, which is the second of the series, which
okay.
was a fantastic honor. So yeah, it's doing pretty well. Fourth book, I have great hopes for, comes out on 29th of June, and we'll see how Cass does in that one.
Yeah. Yeah, no, for sure. I, you know, cause I, when I, had picked it up, I would like realized I was like, wait, this is the fourth one. Like, do I have to read the first three in order to like, you know, follow along? Yeah. And I
What series writers sort of try to do is sort of have each book sort of be contained on its own. There might be a few threads to sort of carry through from book to book.
Sure.
You know, but when you read a book, it's complete on its own. And then we have the sort of underlying things that sort of trickle on to the next one. So it's sort of like having a grappling hook. You end it at a point where you can sort of hook on to the next one in a pretty easy way, and then take off from there.
Yeah, exactly.
But we try to help you out as much as we can.
No, yeah, for sure. Because now I'm like, no, it was written so well in it, and it, you know, it kept me hooked. I think I do. I'm finding myself, I think I... If I had to pick a favorite genre, I think crime mystery novels are up there, whether they're like the cozy murder mysteries or they're like, you know, more serious. I enjoy I enjoy the chase and being pulled along and getting fooled and, like, you know, like where I think the jig is up, but then I'm completely off. And I find myself at, like, if as long as you can, you know, what works and you connect the dots, and eventually it turns out to be something bigger than you could have thought. Cause it, you know, cause we're talking about, in this one, she's asked to find someone's missing daughter, runaway essentially, and who is a foster child, and who's, you know, of course, she's getting to know this girl's history, and you know, she's like 16 years old, and they're like, well, she's run away before, and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, of course, you know, it's easy to have those assumptions. And then you find out if she, like, finds her clues, she contacts like her connections and stuff, and where I'm assuming a lot of them are from previous books. So now I'm like, oh, like, I want to know about this relationship now. So I want to, like, go back and, like, start, you know, from the first one. But it was, I think, yeah, like I find myself enjoying the crime novels a little bit more than other genres. And so I think that's why I was like, oh man, like, okay, now I want to read the rest of them, even though it's like, you know, now I'll recognize the names at least of just going back. But yeah, so no, that's really cool. And so you just kind of gravitated towards the crime novel genre because you, it's just kind of the same, like, you enjoyed it as well.
Yeah, it's just a genre that I enjoyed reading. I particularly like the PI character, sort of outsider character, own set of rules, sort of zigging when everybody else zags.
Yeah,
I just sort of like that sort of a rebel character, and just sort of what to put my own spin on it. So it's not like I'm, you know, reinventing the wheel. The wheel's already there. I'm just sort of putting my little take on it. So yeah, I kind of like it.
Yeah, no, I like it too. It's working out very well, I would say. So you did a mentorship, right? With, like, what do I have in my notes here? Eleanor Taylor Bland.
Yeah.
So did she, was she like a huge influence, or like kind of, you know, having you either master your craft or get started?
You know what? Eleanor was a really great motivator for me. I think I was still in college, early first or second year, and I was sort of schlepped myself up to Northwestern University for this wonderful mystery conference that they had every year. Dark and Stormy Nights, it was called. And, you know, there were very few African-American writers in there.
Sure.
My little old self coming in there and my little two-seater car all the way up to the north side to Northwestern, not knowing anybody. And she was one of the first people that I saw that looked like me. And at that point, you sort of have authors who are there going through the panels and sort of teaching you how to sort of do pacing and dialogue. And
yeah.
So it's a wonderful day. It started at 9, went all the way till 5. So you would just go from room to room and sort of learn what you didn't know. And Eleanor sort of pulled me aside one of those first years and said, what are you doing here? And I explained, I am here because I want to write mysteries. And she sort of looked at my pages, little rabbit-eared little pages that I had with me. And she said, you know what? This is pretty good. Why don't you take my telephone number and my email and send me what you've got after this? And so that started a relationship that went on, you know, several years until, unfortunately, you know, she passed away. And we sort of got to the point where she was a friend and a mentor and a motivator. And I sort of wanted to sort of keep writing because she told me I had something of value and to sort of keep writing. So yeah, I would very much count her as a mentor of mine, and I miss her today. I will probably miss her always. But yeah, that's what I sort of tell new writers coming up. All you have to do is just to keep writing.
Yeah. Yeah. That was actually what I've, was going to be one of my questions. Like, what, you know, writers starting out, even if they're young or maybe they're middle-aged and they're giving it a shot, unpublished authors, you know, what kind of advice would you give to them, and then even your younger self, like, after all of this time, after these published works, and you've been through, you know, through the whole song and dance several times, like, you know, what kind of advice would you give to yourself in addition to, like, younger or new writers?
Just that, keep writing. This is a really hard job to have. It's very easily to sort of get distracted and dejected and want to give up, put the manuscript in a drawer and never look at it again. In fact, there were 2 years out of there in those early years where my manuscript was in a drawer, and it was in the drawer for 2 years. I had sort of decided after rejection, after rejection, after rejection, that maybe this was not for me. Maybe I should sort of move on to something else. But there's always that sort of little nugget of something in the pit of your stomach that tells you you're not doing what you need to be doing. And so, again, you sort of wrap yourself up, drag it out of the drawer, and you start again. And I did that numerous times over the span of sort of teaching myself how to do it. So my advice to young writers, any writer, is just to keep going forward, because there are going to be forces out there that are going to make you want to stop. There are going to be those rejection letters that pile up and come in every day. And you just have to sort of have it in your thought and in your mind that you have something of value, and that if you just keep going, your time will come. Whether that takes 1 or 5 months or 5 years, you have to sort of be in it for the long haul and have to sort of know that you're on the right path and all you have to do is keep going.
Yeah, no, that's really powerful too, because I think that's that kind of mentality it can apply to so many projects, so many industries, whatever, you know, anybody who's trying to do something, you know, I guess it would be more for an entrepreneurial advice, somebody who's doing something on their own. But yeah, no, I that's the one thing that I just kind of like, it's like a common thing whenever I ask authors, like, you know, what kind of advice would you give, or do you follow your own advice type of thing? And it's like, yeah, it's very common for people to just kind of say like, just keep one day at a time, one foot in front of the other, you know,
and it's kind of hard to sort of get to that point. The writing's hard. No ifs, ands, or buts. It's just difficult. And it's very easy to sort of get to stop. It's very easy to stop. It's like sort of running a marathon and stopping at mile two because, you know, your feet. If you stop at mile two, that's as far as you're going to get. You have to keep going. You have to sort of believe and know that something is going to happen. You're going to get better. You're going to learn how to tell a more perfect story or a better story. You're going to find some things that are easier. You know how to do this. So we're going to go forward and sort of see how better we can get at it. It's all learning. It's all teaching yourself how to do it. It's all sort of getting yourself in that sort of frame of mind that I can do it. I can get to that end. I can write the end on that last page. It's just a matter of do it.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's like you're not going to finish if you don't keep going. So like, I mean, if you keep stalling and you keep getting discouraged, it's just going to take you longer.
Just have to do it.
No, and then it's funny that you use the marathon analogy, because I've done two of them, the Chicago Marathon. I've done it twice, and you know, I'm not fast. I go at a pace where I could just keep going. So, it took me a long time, but yeah, that was it. Like, you know, if I slow down, that's not stopping. Cause if I stop and walk, like, then it's going to be that much harder for me to pick it back up again. So it's like, you're exactly right. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to like your writing process or like, whatever, you know, that entails, everybody's is different. I guess we could talk about crime specifically, but maybe it's not because you like it so much. What was the most challenging part of writing? I guess this is a two-part question. So what's the most challenging part of writing crime? And then what were your favorite parts to write?
Well, when I was sort of way back in that sort of conference stage, there was one panelist who sort of described it as, well, every book is either character driven or plot driven. And I knew right at that moment, sitting in that chair with my little dog-eared pages, that I was going to write character driven stories, because that's where my head is. That's where my interest is. So it became very difficult for me starting out to sort of create or build characters. You have to sort of build your world. You have to build your setting, and you also have to build your cast. So that took a lot of sort of fine-tuning, really digging deep into human nature and what motivates people, real people, and just sort of try to translate that onto the page, into a book. You just sort of try to sort of make your characters as human as you can possibly make them, with flaws and blind spots and all of those wonderful things that sort of act as sort of rocket fuel for fiction. So I think I spent a lot of time on that. If I knew I wanted to write character-driven stories, then I had to sort of concentrate on building characters that would engage readers, characters that readers could identify with, characters that sort of emulated humanity and human nature and the flaws of human nature. So I spent a lot of time on that. Plot, not so much, because I don't, you know, I get from the beginning to the end some kind of way.
Sure.
I'm a pantser, so I don't outline, you know, how the story's going to go.
Oh, okay, okay.
I write until I get sort of stuck, and then I sort of step back and figure out where I took the wrong turn, and then I go back, and then I fix it, and then I go on again. So plot's fine. I have to have it. Otherwise, they're just sort of meandering around like they're in the field somewhere, you know, but I'm sort of concentrating basically on character. I want to make these characters as real as I possibly can and to sort of elicit some kind of response from a reader, whether that's hate or love or compassion or whatever. They either love or hate them, but they're distinctive. They're pop off the page, I hope. At least I hope they do. And, you know, so that's the goal for me, to write characters that people either love or hate, but also want to sort of follow and see where they go.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I definitely got that, like, when you're writing your characters, because I know that you're from Chicago, correct? So, like, right. Were there any, like, you know, you kind of say, like, you want to make, you know, you want to make sure the characters are relatable, believable, authentic. Did you happen to, like, people watch and maybe take some characteristics and play around with them? Or are there you know, any personal experiences that found their way into, you know, any, it could maybe not necessarily the characters, but maybe not the plot. I don't know. You said you're not, you don't care about, you're not, you don't focus so much about plot, but any other elements of the story, any you know, real life, you know,
I
little
think
tidbits.
All writers are people watchers. We are the ones sitting next to you on the bus who look like we're reading, but we're not. We're listening to your conversation, all right? We are the people in the coffee shop who are sitting in the booth behind you, seemingly eating our eggs and bacon, but listening to your conversation, invested in the outcome of it. So we are always sort of getting this information in, filing it away. It might turn up in this book that we're working on or five books down the line, but we're receptacles for everything. Drama, tragedy, we're all for it. We're all in, and we just sort of stuck it away. So for each one of my books, the characters are people that I might have encountered anywhere, in Starbucks or whatever. You just sort of hang on to the way people walk and talk and sort of engage with each other. You might find an interesting facial expression somewhere, file it away, and you might use that for a character that you need in the book that you're working on, or again, five down the line. So yeah, we suck things in, retain it, and we use it as we need it.
Yeah. No, that's fascinating.
You just have to be careful where, if you know you're sitting next to a writer, just be careful what you're saying. Okay? Because we are listening to you, and it might end up on page 56 of books.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, it might have been a little difficult recently since, you know, the world kind of shut down for a little bit.
And again, we
running out of material.
Yeah. Writers starve to death. All right. We're in our homes by ourselves. Nobody there to sort of listen in on or talk to. And we have nothing to do. We have nothing to write.
Yeah, it's like now you got to make something up out of thin air. Like,
yeah, you're just 10 times harder.
No, you're already doing that. Like, come on. So how is releasing this book differ from the first three, since times were obviously different? And, you know, your experience, you've done the whole song and dance before of getting it published, or not just, you know, the editing and all that, but also, you know, doing the press, stuff like this. So how was, like, this experience of this release kind of differ, you know, from your previous ones?
Well, everything's virtual, so that's kind of a added sort of wrinkle to it. You don't have that sort of one-on-one contact with readers and book owners and stuff like that, so it's kind of sort of sanitized sort of a way. You know, but we sort of get it done. We sort of learn how to sort of pivot and sort of learn this new medium and sort of try to get some kind of connection through that, the Zoom and podcast and all the rest of that. It's not the same as being there. And hopefully we'll get back to that at some point.
Yeah.
We'll sort of have this sort of hybrid thing where we do a little bit of this, but mostly in person. So that's what I'm hoping for, even for an introvert like myself. It takes a lot for an introvert like me to sort of
crave,
you know, to crave the connection.
Yeah.
But yeah, you miss it and you want to sort of look readers in the eye and sort of talk to them one-on-one. And it's kind of difficult to do that now. So hopefully we'll get back to it pretty soon. But yeah, we're sort of starving and sort of sitting in the wilderness days. I mean, how do you sort of do it? I mean,
yeah, I don't know. Everybody's had to get creative, and it is like a different vibe because you miss those opportunities to feed off the energy of everybody around you, people who are excited to read your work and you know, see, and you know, the physical copy is something that the physical copy of a book offers differently than, because obviously you have a book on your e-reader or your Kindle, like that's safe, right? Like your personal book, you're not worried about like coming into contact or you know. Right. But yeah, it's like, of course you miss being in the physical location and feeding off that energy and meeting the readers and all that. So it's like everybody's had to get a little more creative.
And I think everybody's sort of getting tired of sort of being apart. It's been over a year now, so everybody's Zoom fatigue and all the rest of that. But I think we'll get back to it. It's just going to take a little bit more time.
No, it's going to. Yeah, that's the one thing that I kind of, you know, and it is like a running theme, I think, of the pandemic, was that everybody was like just had to confront their mental health, like because there's not so many distractions and there's not these like normal like your favorite hobbies or vices that you can like, you know, go-tos, and it's like you know everybody's just kind of had to figure it out but we're all kind of like, you know, no, you're not really alone. It's like everybody's having a hard time you know, but that's kind of like what my mentality was. I was like, well, even if it's a couple years from now, it's still going to suck, but it's like a couple years later, like hopefully things will be back to normal or closer to normal. And then I was pregnant and during quarantine. So it was like, I don't feel like maybe I wasn't missing out anyway. Like if everything was closed, I couldn't really do anything anyway.
Right.
But I was just kind of like, time seemed to pass by slowly. But now that I look back on it, I'm like, well, I think it was just the pregnancy that went by slowly, and in general, like COVID, it was just, you miss the socializing, and you miss, you know, even if as an introvert, if you're like, no, I'm burnt out, I'm ready, like I'm tired of these four walls.
That's how bad it is.
Yeah,
I think we'll all eventually sort of stumble back out into the sun like vampires.
And yeah, exactly.
Get back to normal. It's just gonna take maybe a few more months or so.
I know. I'm just like,
knock on wood.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. And plus it's like with the warmer weather coming around, at least there's like more opportunities to maybe do things safer, until we get to that point. But yeah, cause I think, the first time I started doing these interviews was C2E2. And that was like 2 weeks before everything shut down. And so I was like, okay, well, I'm glad we got some stuff before that. Cause then after that, you know, we had to like just get creative, and luckily it's been, I've still had opportunities to get in touch with authors and read some great books and stuff. And so that's why, and then I think C2E2 obviously was postponed, but I think they're supposed to hold it in December this year, which is, I think, is going to be weird. Cause it's, I mean, usually it's like in March ish or end of February, and now it's in December, which the weather's not going to be fun anyway, but you know, you're cause I haven't read the first three ones. So this one, when you were a runner, when you were describing like the winter, I was like, oh yeah, she's from here. <It's> like,
oh like,
yeah,
special kind of experience.
It really is. It's so funny because I went, I traveled to Ireland a couple years ago, and there was people that we met, I think it was like chatting with, who were from New York, and they heard we were from Chicago. They're like, oh my God, like you guys had such bad winters. Like I see, you know, YouTube videos of people like throwing boiling water outside. And I'm like, yeah, it's like, and Chicago doesn't shut down for anything. Like,
no.
They're just like, what? Just wear two extra pairs of pants. And
like, I like to think that it builds character. If you can survive the winter, you can survive anything.
Seriously.
Dig yourself out and see how you do.
Exactly.
You survive, you're good.
Right. That's exactly. No, I was like, well, it's making you tough.
It's toughen you up. Yeah.
For sure.
They're worthy of continuing on to your life.
Exactly. You pass the test. You're worthy of the space. So like, you know, Cass Rains, she's like in her mid-30s, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
When we meet her in book one, she's 32. She's just turned 32. I think when we pick up on Borrowed Time, this bad thing has happened to her, and she sort of pivoted into this new career choice. She's aged 2 years. And then third book and the fourth book, I age her months for each one. So she's, 35-ish in runner, or 36. Not too fast. Just with her. Sort of age into it and sort of creep along a little bit. I don't want her to get like 50 and then I still got, you know, where do you go from that? I mean, she's not going to be
maybe like be a little realistic, right? Because she's running around like
just a little bit,
talking to, you know, some sketchy characters and
running around. Like, you can't do that at 55,
right? Yeah, so and it is in first person, and so was it like difficult to kind of write from a point of view of someone like younger, or even if, you know, you have to like create different characters even that if it's not in first person, is it challenging kind of like, you know, going back to the character creation, like going back, you know, is it challenging to write people of like different backgrounds or different ages and different experiences, like in their lives, different professions, all that?
I think it is. I think that's probably what takes writers so much time, to sort of get into the head of people who may or may not be like you. It's not just, it's not writing fiction if you're putting yourself completely on the page. There are some certain aspects of your personality, maybe in one or two characters, but you're writing characters. So luckily for me, Cass's voice sort of came into my head maybe around 12 or 13 years old. So I've been sort of living with her for quite a long time now.
Okay.
So I knew her quite intimately, I thought, but I learned different things about her from book to book. So I think I know her. And then I put her in a position where she has to take some action or do something sort of drastic. And I learned something else about her. So it's all sort of education and sort of having, putting her in situations where she sort of stretches and expands and I learn a little bit more. And you do the same with secondary characters too. You don't want them to sort of be cut out of characters. You want them to sort of be sort of rounded. You want them to sort of have some positive and negative things going on. You want to make them, again, as real as you can possibly make them. So it takes quite a lot of time for me, at least. I don't do character sketches or anything like that because, of course, I'm a pantser and I have no idea how to do that. I'm pretty sure it's probably a really good process to have for outliners. I sort of envy them at some point, but I just sort of wing it. I sit down. I have an idea of what I want the story to be about and where I want the characters to go. And then I just sort of sit down and write until I get stuck and stop and sort of stop and start. So the same with the characters too. So I put them down there. I sort of think that's who they're going to be. And then I put them in situations where they either prove me right or they prove me wrong. And then that could sort of open up a wonderful path to take. So yeah, it's all fun and exciting and challenging. So that's what takes most of my time. And then, of course, I throw in a plot somewhere just so, just so some things finish and the killer is killed and all that stuff sort of happens. So,
the meat and potatoes, maybe. That little thing.
That important stuff readers sort of like. I mean, they apparently like resolution at the end, which is kind of a sort of a, you know, a burden.
So you said you kind of had her kind of like, you know, blooming in your head at like 12 to 13. So like at that point, was that, you know, you said like you started just with the love of reading and then eventually you kind of were like, well, maybe we'll see if I can write or let's see how this works. And, but you essentially like taught yourself, which I think is super cool. So like, did you know, like when you were, had a character in your mind, when you had Cass in your mind, did you know someday I'm going to give her a story or several stories, or was it kind of like she just never left you alone?
She never left me alone. I already knew I wanted to write, you know, but it's not something you sort of normally tell people, right? You're an 8-year-old kid. They always ask you, what do you want to do when you grow up? And you go, I want to be a writer. You know, no. Okay. Hemingway was a writer. Faulkner was a writer. You have to find something that you're going to do because I'm pretty darn sure that you're not going to be Hemingway. So you don't tell people that you're going to be a writer at 8 or 9. I always would tell them maybe that I'm going to be a lawyer or whatever, some stupid thing that I sort of pulled out of the air. I knew darn well that I was not going to be a lawyer, you know, but it's not something that you're going to tell people at 8 or 9. So I always knew I wanted to write. I always wrote little stories in my little notebook and put it under my mattress. So I had that going. I just had no idea how to do it. I didn't know the beginning, middle, or end. I didn't know how to get started. I didn't know how to develop characters. I had no zip about dialogue and pacing and setting and all of that good stuff. I just knew that this was something that I thought I might be good at, something that I enjoyed doing on my own. And I just wanted to sort of see if I could do it. As I was writing, I mean, reading Nancy Drew and all the rest, I didn't see characters that looked like me. You know, so I'm reading Agatha Christie. I didn't see any little black kids in there running down the St. Mary Mead and doing all that wonderful stuff. You know, so yeah. I wanted to write a book to put myself in there and people that I sort of grew up with and knew and had some experience with on the page. So it became a journey of sort of teaching myself how to put this stuff down paper. Then several years trying to make it good. And then several years after that, trying to get published, querying, getting rejected, starting again, putting it in a drawer for 2 years, digging it out, starting again.
Yeah.
So it was quite a process. I mean, I think it's probably the same for all writers, right?
Sure.
They have those ups and downs and the rejection letters, which are debilitating when you get them. But then that's the point where you have to sort of decide whether you're going to let somebody else decide whether or not your stuff is good, or whether you're going to either take that constructive criticism if they give it. Most times they don't. And sort of make the adjustment or learn what you don't know. That's always sort of hard for writers, I think. You sort of get to the thing where you've got your manuscript and you think it's perfect. But take the criticism, take the constructive criticism.
Yeah.
If somebody's telling you that maybe this might be better, or maybe you sort of missed an opportunity here, don't get defensive and say, well,
right.
You know, I've written what I think is perfect and I'm going to leave it that way. listen, all right, take the advice, take the criticism. If it's something that you think you might have missed, take it, change it, fix it. Make it the best you can be. I think the best way to get published is to write a good story, to give readers a good character, and go from there.
Yeah, no, that's a good point too about being able to accept constructive criticism, because obviously that's like, you know, these stories, like once you finally finish it, like they're, you know, they're your babies, and like you spent so much time and the stories have spent so much time in your head, and you're like, well, like it just comes naturally to you. But then yeah, like once you give it to an editor and you obviously have to trust their expertise, you know, and then when they're telling you something like, no, like this is, you know, you got to do this or you got to do that, or I'm not getting from point A to point B. If it lives in your brain, try to put it on the page, you know? And so, I understand that that's probably like one of the harder parts of it too, is just like to try to not be so, you know, yeah. Like try not to be so, I guess, I don't know,
for
lack of better words.
Yeah. So precious about it.
Exactly. I was going to say sensitive, but yeah.
This is your work. You like it, you know, but you know, it may or may not be as good as you can make it. Editor by day, so I edit other people's stuff from 8 to 5, and then my stuff has to sort of fit in there somewhere. But I sort of learned to not to get too precious about what I've written. If I know it doesn't work and I can see it, I can hear it, I can tell whether or not it's sort of turns the pages for a reader or might, then I have to stop and fix it. Acting like it doesn't stink is not going to help you in the long run, because, you know, the goal is to write an effective story, to write a story that readers are going to really be compelled with and want to engage with. And if it doesn't do that, you've lost. It's either effective or ineffective. If it's ineffective, you have to fix it.
Yeah, exactly. So then, you know, that being said, like when I go back and start with, is Borrowed Time the first one? Borrowed Time is the second one.
Broken Places is the first.
Broken Places, okay.
Borrowed Time is number two.
Okay. And then there's What They Don't Tell You, or
What You Don't See is number three. Close.
I was almost there. I had the right idea.
You almost had.
My apologies. So if I go to Broken Pieces, am I going to see a big difference? Like, do you think you've grown a lot from like 1 to 4?
I think in terms of craft, I think so. I think you get better every book. You sort of learn how to get more effective with it. Things become a little easier because you can sort of know what works and what doesn't work. You can sort of hear it when you read the sentences back to yourself. So you get more efficient, I think. You get more comfortable with the process of writing a book. Even the idea of writing a book is frightening. But the more you do it, as you go from book one to book two and three and four, it doesn't get any easier in terms of writing the story. It's still difficult, but you don't panic as much. But when you get to 3 and 2 and whatever, that you've done it before, you survived, you did not die, okay? You sort of got to the end that first, second, and third time. Chances are pretty good that you can do it a fourth time and a fifth time and a sixth. So right. The panic sort of dies down. The challenge of putting it down on paper remains the same. Every book is its own mountain. You have to climb it. There's nobody there to help you. You can commiserate with your writer friends on a Friday night or whatever, normally when we've got out of the house, but whatever. But it's you. It's you and that laptop, you and that legal pad, you and that pen. That's it. And you sort of have to sort of climb that mountain all alone, no Sherpa, no aid, no nothing. Okay. You just sort of have to get it done. So you learn how to do it. You don't panic as much as you go from book to book, but it's still difficult. So
that's a healthy, outlook to have, just to be like, well, it's like, you hope you would improve, right? You hope that you learn you get better.
Yeah. You sort of go through stories and sort of you tighten it as you tighten and revise, you can sort of teach yourself how to say more with less. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably the most simplest thing, simplest way to say it. Just sort of learn how to get more efficient with it. You learn how to bring characters to the forefront sooner, more succinctly. You don't sort of have all that extra fluff and stuff in there. So you just sort of...
Oop, did I lose you? So Tracy, you are frozen. Let's see.
I can still hear you. Can you hear me?
Oh, I can hear you now. Okay. Your screen was frozen a little bit, and then now I just heard you. Okay. So I was going to piggyback off of that and kind of like circle back to something you had mentioned before, with like character building and stuff and how, making them relatable and flawed and authentic. And mm-hmm. One thing I liked about what you did with Cass, I forget the nun's name. I think it was Marianne, Sister Marianne, mm-hmm. driving the love bus. it's like she just met Cass, and then, she's only spent a couple days with her, and she immediately like had no problem like telling her about herself. And she, and she was just like explaining to Cass, like, kind of like you're kind of like a bulldozer, like you don't leave people be or something like that. And I just remember like once that character kind of pointed that out. And then I like reflected a little bit and I'm like, oh yeah, she's got a point. Like she, but like where she, she takes it. It's like, there are certain points where I think she was like pursuing leads on Ramona, and she approaches Scoot and like she chases him. Mm-hmm. And, it's like the reader, me, myself, I'm like, why? Like, okay, call it a wash. Try a different time. Like, why did you chase him down? Like, why did you? And everybody that she encounters is telling you, like, I don't know why you did that. I can't believe you did that. Don't do it again. Like, don't. And like, she didn't have her phone. She didn't have like anything that, yep. Could help, like, help her get back to anything. And it's, it's like being from the area. It's like, I kind of, it's like, yeah, I'm from around here, but even then I'm like, there's certain parts that I just don't go to. No matter what kind of car I'm driving or anything. And it's, it was just like, it's like, that's one thing that reminded me of is that, you did get that point across. You did it very well where she, Cass is like, there's so many things I admire about her, but some of the things, the actions she takes, like, I'm like, oh no, like, but that ended up being like such a crucial action, mm-hmm. and a crucial point into her, closing in on what she had to do. And, I don't think she would have been as successful had she not taken. It's been made a stupid decision, but even though it paid off.
You know, she's like a dog with a bone. That's her in an essence. She gets a hold of something and she doesn't stop. She's like the Terminator or the Energizer Bunny. She just keeps going, whether or not it's foolhardy or not. This kid is out there. This kid is, in her mind, in danger, and she needs to be somewhere where she's going to be safe. And whether or not she has to go out there at 2 o'clock in the morning and run down a dark alley or whatever she has to do, she's going to sort of follow that lead so she could get this kid and so she can move on to trying to help her. So, she's kind of foolhardy, a little brash, as Sister Marion said, sort of not a deep well in certain areas. You know, but she gets
I love some of the descriptions. I was just like, oh, that's a good one. Like,
I probably got that from a coffee shop somewhere.
Oh, did you? There we go. Comes full circle. And then I think I also enjoyed the scene when she's arguing with, I think his name was Deke, the cook at her restaurant. And also kind of like, you know, you kind of describe like, oh, her favorite waitress, like, wasn't like, she wasn't working. And so she just didn't even go to the restaurant. And I was like, what? That is like some subtle, like, gives you such an in about like who she is, where she's not cool with, she likes her routine. She likes expectations being met. You know, she doesn't like being thrown off her game or she doesn't really like surprises. And I'm kind of like, well, you're a private investigator. Like, what? That's kind of like, you know, and then I think the conversation with Deke, it was so funny because I was like, because it was the fourth book and I'm meeting her at number four. He was also kind of like, you know, he was getting into it with her and she was just so confused. Like, what? Like, I haven't spoken to you. And I'm like, yeah, okay, well, I'm going to learn that then when I go back to number one and start. Cause I'm like, well, I'm meeting her. I'm like, I'm confused too. Like, what's this guy's problem? You know, well,
they've got a long history. All right. Okay. Of him being really cantankerous. He throws people out of his diner. He really is not socialized. Well, okay. So in books 1 through 3, he barely talks to her. In fact, she's been going to that diner for maybe 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
She could probably count on one hand the number of times she's actually heard him speak in a similar voice. And so now she maybe have this sort of back and forth about the kids. Now they are learning a little bit about each other. She still cannot understand where he's coming from. She doesn't have enough information. It's just weird that he's talking to her to this extent. And she doesn't know how to process it. I mean, this is going to take quite a while to get to the end of that. But this is sort of a shock for her.
Yeah. And I kind of like, because I was wondering, like, why is he, you know, I was kind of confused too. Like, why is he so angry? And then he eventually says they don't pay or something. Like, right. And maybe it's because he knew he was going to do that then. Like, he knew he was going to feel obligated, but he just didn't want to have to be in the position where he couldn't say no. Like, that's kind of like the gist that I got, or the impression that I got just from jumping into, you know, that point in their quote-unquote relationships, whatever you want to call it.
As you sort of build characters and sort of layer them, right? There's a lot that we know about Deke when we get to book 4, but there's a lot that we don't know. So his connection with these kids and his feelings about these children are going to sort of pop up again. It's not so much that they are in his diner and not paying, but they remind him of something. Cass is going to have to sort of figure what that thing is and help him with that in a sort of a later book if we sort of get there. I've got 2 standalones to do first, there's a deeper story there. There's an avenue that I can sort of pull a thread on, and we're going to get back to that at some point. But yeah, he busts the kids out of his diner, but for a different reason. And it should be delicious when we actually get to that point of discovering
awesome.
What that is.
Yeah, because I did, you know, at the end I was like, you know, yeah, you got the gist that you just left it open, that like you plan to continue, you know, give her another runaround, give her another, you know, project, give her another chase. And, you know, because I think it was like, because I forget her friend, her best friend's name, who was, she was trying to chase down. He was like doing a job. One of her friends that she grew up with.
Whip.
Yes. Yeah. Where she, yeah, she was like, well, I'm going to figure out what's going on with him. Yeah. And then, like, and so, you know, but it was so funny because it's like, that's another example of her not really letting something go, where she's just kind of going for it. She's chasing it. She's like,
dog with a bone.
Yeah. Yeah. And she's relentless. But I'm like, you know, I'm like, no, maybe that's why she's doing what she's doing then. Cause even though she sometimes makes really stupid decisions, they end up paying off, in the long run. And so, yeah, it was like, yeah, once that end, I got to the end and I was like, well, all right. All right. So there's going to be more here. There's going to be another story. There's going to be another, tale to tell. And I, you know, now that you mention it, like, oh no, we're going to see more of him. We're going to get dive deeper into what he's about. Then that also like just kind of shows you are like very character driven. You're very like, you focus on the people and, you know, having the people's story tell the story kind of. And so, I think, no, I think that's, maybe that's why it was so like engaging, because I think I do like, you know, I think I'm a little sucker for like character growth, you know, and getting to know characters. And I think it's fascinating how authors, they have to, you know, like create personalities and then create situations and judge how these personalities would react to these situations. So, you know, and it's refreshing for you to just straight up be like, no, it's hard. It's difficult. I drive myself crazy. Like it's, you know, and I, yeah, where you have to like do whatever you can to push through it, whatever writer's block or whatever you want to call it. And so I think that, yeah, that part of it is like fascinating, the whole character, you know, making them layered, making them authentic. And you do it very well. And that's why I was like, well, now, you know, you hear, you did a good job of like kind of where I jumped in at number four, but the little holes were filled in. It's where it's like, cause I've done it before. This is the first time I've ever picked up a book without reading the earlier installments. And I didn't know how I would feel about it, but I'm like, well, if it's like a crime solving, like mystery novel, then it's probably designed that way. And so when, you know, when I was reading it, I was just like, I've read other stories where I have read them in sequence. And then when you get to those parts that are supposed to fill the holes, I'm just like, well, okay, yeah, I know this already. Like what? Okay. Let's get on with it. But now I'm like, okay, no, this is why they do that. Like this is like for people in situations like right now, where I can still get hooked into the story without having met her before, without having gotten familiar with her past. Like other, I get little clues, but now I'm like, no, I'm gonna have to go back. I'll just get the audiobooks so that I can just, you know, cruise it, like, you know, just be randomly walking or and like on my commute and you know, getting caught up. But that's, which will be interesting too, because it's sometimes when I listen to audiobooks, it's like if the narrator, the voice actor is not like matching with how I might have pictured it, it throws me off a little bit. So, you know, I'm hoping that
it's the same for us too. When I sort of heard the first audiobook of Broken Places, and I was like, who is this woman? I mean, that doesn't sound at all like Cass does, but it's good. It's good if you don't know who Cass is, but you know, when you practice voice in your head from the age of 12 or 13, and you sort of hear this voice, whoa, who's that? But you know, but you get sort of used to it, and you know, I guess. But the sort of breadcrumb sort of a thing dropping in is the great thing about series. You sort of get to sort of grow into characters. You sort of worry about them. You want to see whether or not they succeed on a personal level. You know, so those little things that you sort of drop from book to book grows them a little bit. They might take two steps forward, one back. They sort of operate like real people do. They get some things right. They get some things wrong. And they continue to sort of hit their head against the wall like humans do. And they learn, or they don't. So it almost is more fun if they don't. But you sort of have that sort of exciting exchange. So it's good. It's exciting, hard and difficult, but also fun and enjoyable.
Oh, for sure. And it's that much more rewarding too. I think once you finally nail it, once you finally finish it, it's just like all that hard work just kind of like it paid off. And just like, kind of a couple, just before we wrap up here, a couple of questions. So, you know, what you earlier you had talked about kind of like, I did want to touch about like on the representation. I think it's so important. I think it's so cool. You know, and awesome that she, cause I'm grateful for the opportunity to like read books from different writers of all different backgrounds and stuff. And so I, you know, that's why I say like, you know, if I think if you look, you, if you know where to look, you can find it, but I think it depends. Mm-hmm. And it's, I think it's like so important for, you know, the representation, all of that. But that kind of like, when you said something about the voice acting and how it doesn't like really sound, you know, when you listen to your own audiobooks, mm-hmm. it doesn't really sound like how you envisioned people to sound. Where, who did you like, maybe like if there was any screen or like screen, like film adaptations, is there any like buddy that any actress that you like envisioned, you know, might play Cass?
I thought about that a little bit, not a lot, because writing books is kind of difficult and
sure.
all the energy's there. But no, not really. Her yeah. voice, I think, is pretty distinctive. I don't see anybody out there who looks like her or sounds like her. She's sort of an entity unto herself.
Yeah.
If I ever get to that point where somebody wants to make a TV show or a movie out of it, they're going to have a tough job. I mean, unless they don't consult me and just do whatever. But I just don't see anybody out there who reminds me of her.
Yeah.
She's sort of a snarky and badass. And
yeah,
I just don't see anybody who sort of fits that bill.
Yeah. Yeah. No, for sure. At least nobody, you know. Who knows? There might be somebody out there, but we haven't seen them yet, you know?
We'll see. We'll
yeah.
see. Hopefully that'll be a good problem to have.
Right. So yeah, before we wrap up here, what can we look forward to as far as your future projects, what you're working on, whether it's with Cass or with anything else that you're working on?
Well, I am working on my book 5, which is my first standalone. Mm-hmm. It's entitled at this point Hide. That may change further down the line, but that one will release December of 2022. Not a PI this time. She's still okay. African American female, which is sort of my thing. She's a homicide detective still here in Chicago, because of course I'm lazy and I don't want to sort of research some other city somewhere else. I know Chicago. I live here, and so right. I'm choosing Chicago. So she's a homicide detective, African American female in Chicago, and she and her partner are after a serial killer. So we'll see how that goes. So far, it feels kind of okay, but it's just one or two drafts in. Things will change. Things will firm up, and I'll sort of refine it and sort of get it into a good shape. But it feels good so far, and we'll see what happens. Fingers crossed.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Yeah, and then you've got 2 standalones, you said, and then you'll get back to Cass.
Yeah, we'll see what happens with Cass.
Yeah,
she still has to figure out what is up to.
Yeah.
Whether or not she's going to get all up in his business, or if she's going to step back, which we probably will not.
Because yeah,
it's not in her. So we'll see what she sort of uncovers on that.
Yeah, no, I'm excited. So I'll have time to catch up before you release the next installment then.
Great,
and
great.
No, and I'll be interested to see where you go with the other stuff that you're working on too. But yeah, Tracy Clark, thank you so much. This was so cool. Like I said, Runner, Cass Rain series, you've got 3 more before that, and I'll let readers know now, it's okay if you don't start at number 1. It probably helps though. It probably helps, but I followed along just fine. It's you know, I really enjoyed it. It was a page turner. Great characters, great, like, you know, you pulled me along as a reader. You pulled me along, and it was, I got sucked in, which I love, but you know, my husband doesn't, but you know,
because awesome,
exactly right. So no, I appreciate you taking the time, and I'll be excited. I'll keep an eye out for everything else you've got going on.
Great, thanks Megan.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, and thanks for listening to this Cantina Conversation with Tracy Clark. As always, we appreciate you listening. If this is your first time joining us over at the Nerd Cantina, just would ask you to subscribe and join us over at thenerdcantina.com/community, which will take you to our private Facebook group, and go ahead and enjoy the conversations over there. Thanks again for listening, and we hope to have you join us again next week, nerds. Till then, see you.